Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 462. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in the Spamcast 462, we feature our interview with John M. Quigley. We discussed his new book, Project Management for Automotive Engineers. John co-authored the book with Rupa Shenoy. The book and the ideas in the book are relevant to all types of projects, whether they use Agile or not. A fun and informative conversation. John's bio? John M. Quigley is a principal and founding member of Value Transformation, a product development, training, and cost improvement organization established in 2009. As well as being an electrical and electronic process manager at Volvo Trucks North America, John has an engineering degree from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and two master's degrees from the City University of Seattle. John has nearly 25 years of product development experience, ranging from embedded hardware and software through verification and project management. A quick promo for my upcoming ITMPI webinar. On Wednesday, October 18th, 2017, 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time, I will deliver a webinar titled Product Owners in Agile, The Really Hard Role. In this webinar, you'll learn why an Agile team's product owner has a special obligation for leadership and value delivery. It's a hard role, but we'll discuss making it work. John M. Quigley, co-author of Project Management for Automotive Engineers, A Field Guide, a book you wrote with Rupa J. Shenoy?
Yes, sir.
So, John, you're on the podcast probably about once a month. Bring your wonderful alpha and omega of product development to the cast, but you are also a serial author. And today I'd like to discuss, I think, what is your newest book, Project Management for Automotive Engineers, A Field Guide, published by SAE International. John, why don't you start by telling us why Project Management for Automotive Engineers?
I'd be happy to do that, Tom. And we can maybe take a look at a few less than stellar examples of project outcomes if you look at the news cycle in the last, 6 or 9 months. You see where things don't work as expected. Some project delivers something and everything seems to be okay until some point when it's not. The reality was it probably wasn't okay all along. You just took a while to get to the volume and the right conditions and combination of stimuli and to find out that you got it wrong.
Okay.
GM key switch, for example. I'm not sure we can put the Toyota throttle into that category, but there are probably some pieces of project management work that delivered that to that could have maybe prevented or at least identified the problem earlier.
So you've written this book with Rupa very specifically for project managers in the automotive market. Why is project management in the automotive market any different from project management in, you know, building dams or building other forms of software-hardware combinations?
Okay, that's a good one. I'd say, let's look at IT, for example. A lot of those things may be able to standardize. The hardware is probably already built somewhere, and the software is some customized level something. But in the automotive industry, the hardware is variable and modifiable. And all, you know, there are very few things that are standard. The OEM or original equipment manufacturer specific in many cases. And that has to be wedded to some level of software that goes into it. That may be from the manufacturer. It could be from a different supplier altogether. There are logistics to the hardware going from a prototype part count or prototype delivery of parts to people to run tests of tens, maybe several tens, up to thousands of parts, and rather abruptly when you shift from model year. So the logistics around the material handling is fairly significant in managing that ramp. The consequences for failure can be quite high. The investment in a vehicle is millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars even. And if you get that wrong, that's hundreds of millions of dollars worth of money down the drain. And if you deliver something that's causes harm, that's hundreds of millions of dollars to go backwards. So there are some really big differences between automotive and some of the other applications. It's like a mashup of hardware, unique hardware, and software variability that kind of present some unique challenges to managing the project and making sure the right things are included in the project.
So obviously I can see the significant difference. And as I read through the book, I see the difference between this and an IT project manager in a, you know, standard corporation who's just who's wrangling software. But would you say that people who were doing other forms of hardware software combinations could use this book as a reference or learn? Would they get, is there learnings in this that would be applicable for someone building a ATM?
Yeah, I think so. The system, say the ATM is an individual piece of hardware and software, and it has to interface with a bunch of other different hardware and software throughout. Those kind of things are the things you do to manage the project in relation to the system of the product system could be similar. You could look at what's important here and what kind of tools would I use in the automotive industry to vet the hardware or to understand the interface between the hardware and the software and the variability in that, configuration management and things like that we've talked about before. Those kind of things are kind of discussed in the book, and certain tools kind of help you understand where to apply those. So anybody that makes hardware that has some kind of software valid to it, or even straight up hardware, could probably make use of this book.
If you were going down the path of a hardware software combination, whether it's automotive, ATM, airplane, how would you manage a scenario where part of the work was internal to the organization, part of it was sourced elsewhere? How does that work, and how did you describe that in the book?
That's a good point, because the automotive industry has a lot of outsourced things like that, pieces of the hardware or pieces of the system and pieces of software or entire chunks of the software are outsourced. The thing is to understand the scope as well as you can for that iteration. Contrary to what many people think, a lot of the OEMs or automotive world still works in what would maybe be called waterfall.
OEM?
Original equipment manufacturer, sorry.
Okay.
They work in the vein of a waterfall-ish, stage gate kind of thing. But it's not everything at this. I mean, we've talked about this before. It's not where you have to have all the requirements before you move forward. So for them outsourced pieces, you set some set of requirements that you want to try and explore. You want to explore, so you give that to the supplier, and you have some metric that tells you whether you're being, you know, that you're monitoring the supplier and paying attention to that to see if they're making progress according to some iteration plan. Like, I expect to get this piece of the hardware, that piece of hardware, and that piece of software from these two suppliers, and then I will wed those here and do some interaction testing with them so I can learn from it and then make changes to the requirement spec for both of those things. So, you know, the challenge is to synchronize hardware changes and software changes. That's the same challenge with anybody. And hardware to hardware, in the case of building the vehicle itself, some kind of prototype piece or portion of the vehicle.
Part of whether it's automotive, and again, it's funny because relatively recently I was at a client that made gas sensors, and very much a number of items in the book directly talk to the kinds of things. Again, you'd have to throw away the automotive words, but it was the whole idea of manufacturing. So in chapter 5, one of the things that you talked about, I'm sure you have chapter 5 memorized. was the whole idea, a whole idea of prototyping the assembly line and thinking through that as part of project management. So again, a different level of complexity when you were addressing those kinds of items, so that you, as our friend Gene Houston quoted the other day, so that you didn't have a whole bunch of spare parts sort of interrelated and working together versus a whole system. How do you actually think through that kind of a scenario?
It takes a lot of different perspectives to come to those things. And, because you have to develop the... There's two reasons for developing the manufacturing line. The ultimate is to be able to produce the product at the cost you want, right? But the other part is to build some set of iterations and develop the manufacturing line along the way, right? You kind of know what the product looks like in general, may not know all the details. You sort of know the volume that you expect to sell of this thing. So you start understanding those pieces, and many times if it's an iteration of a product that may already exist, you're looking at expansion or an adjustment to some kind of existing manufacturing line or an adaptation or permutation from some other known way of working. But you have to build those things in parallel while the manufacturing is going on. It's while the development is going on. It's part of the design for manufacturing aspects, DFM, which is design for manufacture. Of the part. So in addition to developing the part, just doing the design so that it fits and acts well within the rest of the system and not this collection of hodgepodge parts that kind of work together, you have to look at the delivery system and the delivery mechanism, that's the manufacturing line, in as a context of the whole system within the project. Often that manufacturing line can be used for those early prototypes too.
Where in the life cycle do you start to get a sense as to how large, you know, how much volume you're going to have to pump through? And when do you start thinking about it as a production line? Or is that just something that's so built into the understanding that's just a natural part of the SDLC?
I think it's a little bit of both. First, when automotive industry, you kind of know what kind of cars you're going to sell, and you kind of know what features and volume those things are going to sell. It's not perfect. I mean, the bottom can fall out and then things crash, but you have a general idea of what the volume is going to be, assuming the economy doesn't crash. So you sort of know, at least for the more common parts of the vehicle, what that volume is going to look like. And there are what milestones of things that should be achieved along the way of your project that focus on particular parts that are manufacturing centric. For example, if we take a look at the entire life cycle, we're looking at the phases. In fact, the book is broken out like this. If anybody is aware of APQP, have anybody seen that Advanced Product Quality Planning graphic from AIAG? The book is more or less lays out like that. The first thing you need to know, obviously, is what I'm trying to do, what's my voice to customer want. Then I'm going to work on a product design. And as I'm doing the product design, I have to also be working the process designs. Now, the process development. The process development is associated with the manufacturing line. So there are a set of tools and things that are more or less in parallel with the product development that are unique for the manufacturing setting. Then you have the verification of the product and a verification of the process, because it does no good to have the perfect design product if your manufacturing processes can't produce it at the right yield, as in for every 50 I make, I can only use 40 or 30 or 10. That's not a way to profitability or even maintainability. Right? So your manufacturing line has to be able to produce a good quality product repeatedly and with a yield that makes some sense. And then you verify both the product and the processes that deliver the product to make sure that they're not only capable, but they're capable over a wide range of varying expectations. In the case of the design, high temperature, low temperature, vibration and humidity, vibration and temperature, thermal shock, I mean, whatever those things are. And in the case of the manufacturing line, you're looking at things like when the board is goes to the wave solder, does the wave soldering, is it sufficient contact that it doesn't behave errantly in the presence of moisture or something like that.
How does the whole concept of project management interact at this scale with product development? Which, you know, those are two very different sets of skills and points of view.
Yeah, they need to be tied well together.
How do you do that?
Yeah, I think the people who can do that repeatedly are really talented. It's a lot of communication with the right area for that particular aspect of the discussion, right? If I'm talking about some design issue, I need to know and think about this system as a whole system, not just the product, but the manufacturing. If I make this change, what are those consequences? Can I just do this? Is it innocuous and it doesn't affect anybody? Or is this the kind of alteration that has some big impact? And I need to know those things before I start making those changes. So you have to have whether you're the product person or the project person, you need to have a wide system understanding of the chunks and what they're focused on.
Okay, so you brought up the term I was just about to ask about, maybe not with exact words, but how do you embed that level of system thinking across a large group? You know, whether the combination of the project manager, the whole idea of the other design components, the other engineers, that sounds like, again, whether it's automotive or it's any other hardware-software combination, how do you embed that level of systems thinking into a group and keep it there over time?
Yeah, that's the hard part, keeping it there over time. I think one of the tools is communication. You spend a lot of time in some form or another that syncs up the parts, the articulating points, right? The manufacturing guys don't care all about the design, but there are very important parts of the design that they really need to know, and not at the last minute. So these articulating points are the ones that you really have to pay attention to and make the right connections within the project team. And the project manager should be somebody that facilitates that. And that should happen, for example, if it's a design issue, the design folks are wanting to make some kind of change, it looks innocuous. It should not be just judged on this, that it doesn't look to have any implications anywhere else in the company. The PM should be thinking and encouraging the other team members to think similarly. Okay, what happens if this happens? What are the downstream effects? And if there seems to be something, and even if you're not sure, you should be having those discussions with those other articulating points that you think might be impacted, aftermarket, manufacturing.
One of the parts of the book that I got a kick out of was the whole discussion of defects and the level of measurement and prediction. Can you talk through some of the techniques used, whether it's things like control charts or whatever, statistical process control? But there are a lot of things that you suggest doing with tracking defects. Why is that important? And
yeah, I think if I remember correctly, in this book, I used a story that I was test manager of a group, and we had a large project, and we used more like a lean agile approach to performing the test, and there were thousands of test cases. I mean, these were two very large vehicle platforms with considerable variability, and when I say there were thousands of test cases, I mean there were thousands of them that were basic. That doesn't include all the exploratory stuff. And we chose to go at this using what I kind of call an agile-ish way, in that we had, I mean, it's not really Scrum, but it was, I stole a lot of things from Scrum when we did this, and essentially looking at the defect arrival rate, the severity of the defects compared to the percent of completion, right? And these metrics kind of tell the project manager something. In fact, they give the project manager some hint of what might be happening next or need to happen next. If you're keeping track of metrics like defect arrival rate, let's say that 3,000 plus test cases, I have performed some low percentage, maybe 3% or something like that. In the course of that 3%, I found defects that were, in this example, the top level defects were 100 points and 25 points. There were also defects at 1, 5, and something else, but with 1.5-point defects, they're the kind of things a customer might not notice, the kind of things a customer might notice but not really care. 25 leaves somebody stranded on the road. 100-point defect is the kind of thing that somebody
that sounds catastrophic.
Yes, somebody may not walk away from that kind of failure, or a whole bunch of somebodies may get injured. So if I run like 10% of my test cases, 10% of 3,000 test cases, and I have found a couple of 100-point failures and a few 25-point failures, I can say something about this system. I can say, as it stands now, this system incarnation is not something that should go to the customer.
Yeah.
I can also theorize that at 10%, if I've found two or three or four or five of these things, that in the remaining 90%, there's not zero. I can be fairly certain that the remaining portion of the system, it still has faults, and there are probably going to be some big ones. Now, that one might not entirely be true, but if you're risk averse, it's probably a good perspective. There's a thing called defect clustering, which means you can expect to see defects kind of clustering a point, and it's possible that all the defects in this system are in this 10%. It's not very probable.
Right. Yeah. I understand the statistics behind that. But, John, when you talk about things like defect clustering, which I agree occurs, do you see that across your experience when you've dealt with just software, hardware? Is that more a artifact of this kind of complex system, or do you see that kind of thing in less complex systems?
I see it in the very complex, and I tell you what it often tells me. It tells me if it points in a if the clustering is from a particular spot, it kind of gives me some idea of where the process problems may be. If I'm seeing a considerable amount of defects in one particular component in the product, as opposed to some of the others, and I may go back and look at how that part of the product's being developed by the supplier. I might look, hey, let's do an audit on your processes. Let's see if you're actually adhering to them, like you say. For example, did you do a design review? Did you do what we call a DFMEA, Design Failure Mode Effects Analysis, which is supposed to critique the design even in advance of the design? You theorize the things that can go wrong, and then you see if you're right about those things by generating some kind of tests or some kind of exploration to see if those things you think are true. And there should be some kind of connection between that and the product development. It's not just a document that you fill out one time and then it sits on a shelf and collects dust. When you see these clusters, it can point to some systemic issues with the development itself.
So what is the outcome of knowing that?
The outcome of knowing that is you can put more attention on those things and start to reduce its impact on your project time, your project schedule, your quality, your cost.
We're dealing in this book with scenarios where failure is catastrophic and people could die.
Yes.
And just to not put too fine a point on it, if you were dealing with less life critical, what parts of this would you ease up on, or would you at all?
I think the tools are beneficial no matter what you do. The depth you go into the tools, maybe you don't need to spend so much time on it. For example, design failure mode effects analysis. That's the thing where you look at the product and you assess it against things like, if this goes wrong, what would the symptom be? What if I have a failure here, what happens? What's the severity? How frequently would that happen, and can I detect it? Those three things, you multiply together and come up with the risk priority number. The higher the number, the worse the problem, and you might need to address it. The activity itself, I think anybody can benefit from. Maybe you don't need to break it down way into the system. Many people, I think, that are working on some kind of complicated system can benefit from that kind of thing, for example. It's like everything, you should tailor what's possible to what you have for an organization and what's at stake, right? We've talked about this a few times on some other things. It's not, there's no silver bullet, But these tools and techniques, I think, are very useful. And certainly the more complicated the system and the more critical the outcome, the more these tools are helpful.
So how do you define complexity? You have worked on, as we have discussed in other locales, you've worked on some pretty complicated pieces. But you've also done work on things that are less complicated. How do you define that term complexity? We toss it around like it's an easy concept, but I'm not convinced that it's easy.
No, it's really not that easy.
It's complex.
Yeah, that's the reason why the word. Yeah. It's I can say this, though. There's complexity in the product, and there's complexity in the things, in the delivery of the product, in the project. The larger the product, more function points, the more requirements, the more regulated by government, you know, and standards that you have to meet, the more articulating points in the product, right? Not just in the case of a truck or a car, the instrument cluster is what it is, but the instrument cluster is connected to a transmission, to an engine, to a whole host of other after-treatment systems, emission systems, entertainment systems. I mean, there's so many things going on, and you're starting to add a lot of complexity when you put all those things together. Aviation's even worse, or even more complex, because of the not just the product, not just the sub-assemblies that constitute the entire of the product, but the processes that deliver the product, the outsourced here, you know, synchronizing hardware and software at certain times that have to match, you know, mismatch between a hardware and software package, that those things can cause bad problems, especially if they're not known.
Yeah, well, the configuration management must be pretty spectacular on some of these larger events, much more involved than a simple website.
Yeah.
If there is such a thing.
Yeah, if there's such a thing. If there's you and I right. doing something, we can probably manage the configuration and change.
Right.
But the minute you and I bring other people into this or have to hand something down or something is compared against some legal statute because something weird happened, now we're talking about a whole different set of unpleasant.
When you wrote Project Management for Automotive Engineers, a Field Guide, obviously you were targeting the automotive market. And I think earlier we said really that this book could be leveraged by anyone working in a highly complex scenario where they're dealing with hardware, software configurations. Are there other areas that you would suggest to our listeners that they should be interested in the book?
Anything that's really touched with manufacturing, too, in volume, because those okay. things also add complexity to it. It's, you know, so even if it's just a mechanical part, but you're building massive quantities of these things, or you're designing it and going to manufacture it, then those are kind of interesting points as well.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting to look at the number of manufacturing organizations, whether it's I'm building controllers for subway cars, or gas monitors, or cars, or airplanes, or even, you know, my Alexa at home. The hardware-software combinations are immense, and so therefore I think this book, even though it has the word automotive engineers in it, is probably very useful for anyone dealing in that level of manufacturing scenario or where they're building hardware-software configurations that have to work together.
Yeah, those variations in the course of the project add that strange word complexity to things, right? If you're building one iteration, one model type, then things are fairly fixed. But if you're building one platform that will propagate many iterations off that platform or variants off that platform, that can be really tough. The passenger car industry is maybe a little bit more, the variations a little more tightly controlled. You know, you can get a car with some driveline variations, that is transmission and engine combinations and interior packages, but there's some limit to the variation there. But I can tell you, in Class 8 or heavy truck, the limits are really, there are none. So if somebody comes in and says, I want to buy 1,000 of these brand new X trucks, if you put Y feature content in it, somebody's going to work really hard to get Y feature content into that complex truck without damaging any of the existing things as a project.
Yeah, absolutely. John, you wrote Project Management for Automotive Engineers, a field guide with Rupa J. Shenoy. John, if people wanted to continue the conversation, they wanted to dive into the book in more detail and have a conversation about it, how would they go about having that conversation?
Well, they can go to, but if they want the conversation, they're going to have to go to Value Transformation or contact me at John M. Quigley on Twitter, or john.quigley@valuetransform.com as my email address, or post something on the discussion board. We have a discussion board over there for APQP and project management stuff, and welcome the exchanges that we may generate over there in that.
John, as you know, you participated on the podcast a number of times, so your contact information will be up on the website. John, as a thank you for bringing the discussion of this wonderful book to the podcast tonight, you know, I open up the platform at this point for you to promote anything that you'd like.
Thank you, Tom. Well, I would like to promote the website because we've done a lot of interesting changes to it. We've added areas for, I guess they're like little games is what I'd call them, to check your understanding on project management and lean activity, lean things, and testing as well, software testing, and discussion boards, like I was saying earlier. I'll send you the link to that because that's a different spot. It's under the site, but it's different. And some online training that we're working on. I've already got a product testing online training. I'm looking for some students there. I've had one cohort go through it already. Not too many people, but it was interesting. It was fun.
Interesting.
Yeah, maybe two, actually. And I look forward to any opportunities to, you know, build something with some folks or exchange some interesting ideas that, upon which we can build and help where I can in general.
Absolutely. And, you know, the listeners, not only to the discussion of Project Management for Automotive Engineers, a field guide, and your wonderful column that you bring to the podcast, the Alpha and Omega of Product Development. John, they should reach out. They should have that conversation. They should engage you. Absolutely.
Again, Tom, I would like to thank you again for all these opportunities you give me, man. I'm very grateful. This is fun. I get animated because it's exciting.
In Reread Saturday News, Stephen this week completes Paul Gibbons' book, The Science of Successful Organizational Change. By the way, fantastic book. I'm glad Stephen reread it with us. And in this edition of Reread Saturday, Stephen delivers final thoughts. Special thanks to Stephen for tackling the reread duties for the past 13 weeks. Next week, we'll do a review of the graphic novel of The Goal, and then we will dive into Actionable Agile Metrics for Predictability, an introduction by Daniel S. Vacanti. Links in the show notes to buy a copy of the book, so that you can read along. A quick call to action. The Software Process and Measurement Cast needs your help to draw additional ears to the cast. Please give the Spamcast a short, honest review in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening. If you leave a review somewhere, please send a copy to spamcastinfo@gmail.com. We'll call you out on the show. Reviews help guide people to the cast. In the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 463, we will feature our essay on using big picture stories to generate resonance. Early in the history of Agile, most descriptions of Agile included the need to define a central metaphor to help guide the work. Somewhere over time, the idea of a central metaphor has disappeared as Agile thought leaders have focused more on tactical facets of Agile methods and frameworks. It's time to reconsider the big picture story. We'll also have columns from Gene Hewson, Form Follows Function, and Jeremy Berrio, the QA Corner. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do people always ask, are we there yet?